Tested is sponsored by Duke Health, home of the Pandemic Response Network, helping communities stay safe and connected during the COVID-19 pandemic by partnering with local school, business, and faith-based organizations to launch COVID-19 system support programs in their own communities. Learn more at pandemicresponsenetwork.org.
I'm Dave DeWitt. This is Tested from WUNC, a look at what the day's challenges tell us about where we are, what we believe, and who we want to be in North Carolina and the South. Today, winter. The next several months are going to be the kind of awful that's hard to even grasp. COVID cases are spiking, setting records in most every state across the country. Overwhelmed hospitals and a horrific number of lonely deaths will follow as we enter the holiday season. There's no silver lining in this, no modicum of pleasure in an I told you so from scientists and doctors who began predicting this surge back in the spring and have continued to do so. Here's the personification of science, Dr. Anthony Fauci, saying exactly that right after Labor Day.
I just think we need to hunker down and get through this fall and winter because it's not going to be easy. We know every time we lift restrictions, we get a blip. I mean, it's whack-a-mole.
Now we're quickly getting to the point where there are too many moles to whack. People we live near, know, and love will die in the coming months. But in one of our nation's most dismal times, we've elected a president who is poised to put science back in a leadership role, and none too soon.
Having a much more coherent national plan around public health measures in terms of making sure resources for PPE and things like that are distributed in a smart way will make a big difference.
Holden Thorpe is editor-in-chief of the Science family of journals and a former chancellor at UNC Chapel Hill. We've talked on this podcast before about the danger of ignoring what scientists have to say about protecting the public from COVID-19. I asked him back to talk about what it means to really listen to the science.
In terms of the rhetoric around the public health measures like masks and social distancing, I hope it will make a difference to have Joe Biden and his folks modeling excellent behavior, but I worry that the 70 million plus people who voted for President Trump are still not going to do it. So, you know, we're going to have to do everything we can to try to get folks on board with what needs to happen. And, you know, what I'm hoping is that now with it appearing very, very likely that we'll have a vaccine that'll start to get distributed in April or something like that, that can bring us to an end of this, that people will see that they're not just doing something indefinitely, that we're building a bridge to a better place. And if folks would keep themselves safe between now and when they can get vaccinated, I think there's a much brighter future waiting for us.
As we're sitting here now, two vaccines look really, really promising. And we talked back in the spring, we kind of discussed various concerns adhering to sort of the long established scientific processes and systems that help keep scientific research and clinical trials safe. And as we appear on the verge of these two vaccines and maybe more in the next, you know, couple of weeks, are you confident that sort of no shortcuts have been taken in that scientific and clinical trial process?
Yeah, I have a lot of trust in the government scientists within the agencies. I think there was a lot of unfortunate hysteresis that happened with the political appointees, with Azar and Hahn in particular. So Stephen Hahn is the director of the Food and Drug Administration, and he has sort of oscillated between science and doing what the president wanted. He approved an emergency use authorization for hydroxychloroquine, which we know doesn't work. He eventually retracted that. Then he gave a press conference about convalescent plasma and said it was a major breakthrough. It's not a major breakthrough. It's hopefully a useful thing for some people, but it's been around for 100 years. What happened then was a bunch of us got worried that he would do the same thing on the vaccine and approve an emergency use authorization for it prematurely. So a bunch of us wrote a lot about how that would be unacceptable. I think we actually got to him. He called my colleague, Eric Topol, who was one of the other people that was really speaking out about this, and eventually agreed that we would have to wait at least 2 months after the second shot for anyone in the vaccine trials before we had a readout. And that happened. And now, as we're seeing with Pfizer and Moderna, those folks have all had at least 2 months since they've had the second shot. And that can make us feel a lot better about the safety of the vaccine. And no, I don't think any shortcuts have been taken. And I think the good thing is that if healthcare workers start to get vaccinated next month, kind of amazing that we're saying that, but yeah. We could have healthcare workers starting to get vaccinated next month. If they do well and they're protected, then hopefully that will help people see that we've got a couple of outstanding vaccines. And who knows, we could have some of these adenovirus vaccines ready before too long as well.
You talked about members of the science community at some government agencies and other places. I mean, what has it meant to the scientific community to have administration, president, and as you mentioned, 70 million people who voted that have been largely anti-science, and now we're looking on the verge of maybe science taking a more forward position and being more trusted. But members of the science community, how have they held up generally?
I think it's been tough. I mean, one of the reasons why I've written as many passionate editorials as I've written has really not been to change public policy, although I think with the FDA thing, a bunch of us banding together actually did have an effect. But the main reason has been to provide support to the folks who have been working so hard to get us this vaccine when they have to listen to their president undermine everything that they're doing. So I think of myself as kind of the cheerleader in chief for the scientific community that's doing all of this. And they want somebody to speak out for them. And I hear from them that they're grateful to me for doing that. But also now, you know, my colleagues at some of the other journals have joined in. And the purpose of this is not, you know, the people who are getting ready to have Thanksgiving dinner with their climate denying uncle, which apparently every scientist has a climate denying uncle because I always hear about that. We're not going to change his mind about climate change. We didn't. This isn't about doing that. This is about keeping the scientific community's morale up so that we could get this done, and we did it. We're very close to doing it, and that's why we've been doing this. But the president undermining science has certainly been a major psychic challenge for science, and it's one that, as we've always done before, we soldiered on anyway. And I think it's also important to remind folks that the people who have worked on this vaccine specifically, obviously they've done a great job, but they're standing on the shoulders of decades of really important research in immunology and virology, and there's a lot of important basic research that this is all standing on the shoulders of.
Holden Thorpe is the editor-in-chief of the Science family of journals. His series of editorials culminated with the magazine's endorsement of Joe Biden for president, the first time Science had endorsed a candidate for president in its 175-year history. Before his current job, Thorpe was the chancellor at UNC Chapel Hill from 2008 to 2013. Hang tight, more in a moment.
Tested is a production of North Carolina Public Radio WUNC. And this is a good time to say thanks to everyone who supports WUNC. Whether you're an individual donor or a business, we can't say thank you enough for providing us with the resources and opportunity to serve the state of North Carolina with up-to-the-minute news and information. Everyone at WUNC is working around the clock to do just that. at this unique and perilous moment in our history. And we couldn't manage without your help. So thanks, and if you are able, please go to WUNC.org if you want to donate for the first time or to maybe increase your support.
The pandemic has forced us to cut back on a lot of things: social contact, travel, expectations for things to return to normal. Some of those cutbacks have had a silver lining. Less car and airline travel has meant lower carbon emissions. But our hunker-down lifestyle has also caused a huge increase in the amount of garbage we've generated. Tested producer Rebecca Martinez wondered how huge. So, Rebecca, I'll be the first to admit that with everything going on, my family's trash production hasn't been the first thing I wake up and worry about day to day.
I know what you mean, Dave. My family's been eating a lot of takeout since the pandemic began, and I'm not proud of it, but we're two working parents raising a growing kid, and food prep often gets edged out of the agenda. By the end of the week, our recycling bin is a lot fuller than it used to be, and we're taking out the trash more often, too.
You're going to ask me questions about the increased waste due to COVID.
Our kind is no mystery to Crystal Dreisbach. She's an advocate I met up with in Durham this week who promotes ways communities can cut down on trash.
I think people are getting more takeout delivered to their home. They're picking up takeout to take home. They're getting groceries delivered to home. They're ordering more on Amazon. And they're doing some panic buying. And all of this leads to more trash coming from the residences.
Dreisbach is the director of a nonprofit called Don't Waste Durham. She cites data from industry trash haulers like Republic Services, which says residential trash collection is up 30%, and the International Solid Waste Association estimates the consumption of single-use plastic has increased as much as 300% since COVID-19 hit the United States.
The last thing they want to do is to try to remember their reusable bags when they go to the grocery store. Environmental problems sort of take a back seat, and that is totally understandable. And I think that is a major factor in where the single-use plastic increase comes from. And I think the solutions that we're building can make it just as easy for people to get their food and their groceries and other things in reusables in a simple way that doesn't take any more emotional energy and can actually maybe decrease the stress.
Don't Waste Durham supports policy and innovations that prevent trash. Dreisbach is advocating for a countywide fee on single-use plastic bags. Her organization also runs a network of reusable green-to-go takeout containers.
It looks like a styrofoam container, but it's much better. It stacks nicely. It has that snap when you close it, and you can actually see your food through it, which is kind of a bonus, and restaurants really like that.
In the new year, they'll also launch boomerang bags. So those fabric shopping bags and takeout containers will be available at local shops and restaurants, and when the users are done with them, they get returned, washed, and sanitized before they're put back into rotation. Dreisbach says the pandemic is no reason to put sustainability on the back burner.
COVID is what I think of as the short-term crisis, the one that everyone can feel and relate immediately to. They do not want their brother to get sick, their children to get sick, their mother to get sick. So that becomes a priority. A lot of times whenever you say the words health and safety, you immediately shut the conversation down about the environmental efforts. But really, while the environment used to be a longer-term game, let's say you're playing the short game, playing the long game, we no longer have time to wait and put environmental efforts on hold. There is a very real environmental crisis happening.
So Rebecca, what did she have to say about plastics, one of the biggest contributors to that crisis?
Yeah, plastics are a major concern because they're environmentally harmful from creation to decay.
The use of petroleum to make products is very pollutive. When things are designed, manufactured to be used only once, this creates trash. So we're polluting all along the cycle of turning this otherwise perfectly fine resource into something that's poison, both for humans and the earth and, frankly, our local economies. Technically, it can be recycled, but that is simply not widespread or even really feasible to solve the problem.
And she's right. Researchers estimate that only 9% of plastics have ever been recycled. 12% have been incinerated, and all the rest remain in landfills or sloughed off as litter on its way to the ocean.
And so what you have is a lot of problems that people don't even think about. Yes, you see plastic bags in the street. Why is that a problem? They go into storm drains. They break down into smaller and smaller pieces. They're eaten by everything from microbes to large mammals. Now, that might not be on the top of people's concerns, but what it means is that plastic pieces, nanoparticles of these plastic pieces, are now crossing boundaries. They are in our air. They're in our water. And we just, you know, we've gotten to a point where we can't really go back, but we can stop it from getting worse.
Dreisbach said she hopes that federal policy will take environmental science seriously and prioritize sustainability.
Thanks, Rebecca. Rebecca Martinez is a producer here at Tested, and that's it for this episode. I'm Dave DeWitt. Charlie Shelton Ormond is also one of our producers. Lindsay Foster Thomas is the executive producer. Thanks for listening.